Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Delighted to be in conversation today with an old friend, Anthony Wood, a grants maker, philanthropic advisor, preservation activist, writer, teacher, and historian. Since 1993, Anthony Wood has been the executive director of the Idelson Foundation. Prior to that, he served as the chief program officer at the J.M. Kaplan Fund. Currently, he also serves as a senior philanthropic advisor to several other foundations. He was an adjunct associate professor of historic preservation in the Columbia University Graduate School of Architecture Planning and Preservation for over 20 years. He holds a master's of urban planning from the University of Illinois, is a graduate of Kenyon College, and was a historic Deerfield Summer Fellow. For over 30 years, Mr. Wood has served on a variety of non-for-profit boards, from small local grassroots organizations to large national not-for-profits. He has served as chair of the Preservation League of New York State, is a former board member of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, is former chair of Partners for Sacred Places, is chairman emeritus of the Historic Districts Council of New York City, and is past chair of the Drayton Hall Site Council, Charleston, South Carolina. And he's the founder and chair of the New York Preservation Archive Project and serves as the chair of the Weston Playhouse Theater Company. Anthony Wood has also served on the boards of mental health and AIDS organizations. He's the author of Preserving New York, Winning the Right to Protect a City's Landmark. Born in New York City and raised in Illinois, he returned to New York City in 1978 and has lived there ever since. He's married to Mr. Anthony Badalamenti. We'll talk with Anthony Wood about all of that. But first, welcome, Anthony Wood.
Great to see you again.
Well, we met a long, long time ago, and you were always extraordinarily helpful to WAMC, and we much appreciate it. But now let's get into your current interests. Let's talk about preservation. What does that mean?
Great. Well, historic preservation is basically a movement now that's been around for well over 100 years, and it's all about trying to preserve the things we care about in around New York State in particular, the great buildings, the historic neighborhoods, the things that really enliven the daily life of so many New Yorkers.
It really is extraordinarily bad when we knock down these great monuments to our past. I was just in Memphis, Tennessee, where urban renewal really struck. And, I know people who lived in Memphis who were just heartbroken over the loss of all of these wonderful places that so many important music and other things happened.
Well, we've made so much progress from those days, but people feel just as passionate today about losing buildings that we try to save. But the good news is we've made a lot of progress. We've got in New York City and New York State the ability to have some pretty strong landmark laws, which give us a chance and the citizens a chance to come forward and try and save threatened buildings.
And some great institutions in New York City, for example, have been saved. Name a couple.
Oh, well, probably the things you like the most about New York are landmarks. Whether it's Radio City Music Hall or the Empire State Building, the Chrysler Building, the big ones that come to mind, but also the neighborhoods that everybody loves to wander in, Greenwich Village, Brooklyn Heights, Upper West Side, Upper East Side, out in the boroughs. There are now over, 135 historic districts or what they call extensions to districts in the city. So a lot of special places have been protected.
Well, what happened to Grand Central Station?
Well, Grand Central Station was threatened at one time.
I remember it.
And
Jackie Kennedy stepped in.
It was terrific. She came forward on her own and called the Municipal Arts Society and said, "Can I help?" And the answer was yes, big time. And she really helped not only dramatize and draw attention to the effort to save Grand Central, but also that became nationally, that had a huge bounce. Obviously, the national news media picked that up. And it really inspired preservation efforts around the country.
So at the time that Grand Central was saved, was there a preservation attachment to it?
Oh, yeah. Grand Central has played actually a key role in the history of preservation because it had been threatened before. But also, the loss of Penn Station, was such a painful thing for New York City. One of a number of events that helped lead to us getting our law.
Terrible. It was terrible.
Oh, all you got to do is walk through today and it just reminds you how much of a loss
you
it was.
You bet.
But in a sense, so the desire was we don't want to lose the other great train station that we have. And so Grand Central has been a rallying cry. And ultimately, the Landmarks Law was frankly put at risk in order to save Grand Central.
Why is that?
Well, up until that time, when the Landmarks Law had been passed, which was in 1965, and actually we're just wrapping up our 50th anniversary multi-year celebration of that great event.
And what year did you say again?
1965 was when the law was passed. April. So this is...
Seems like yesterday.
Well, there you go. Almost yesterday to me, but almost. So when that law was passed, it was, you know, a new law created a new agency. It was untested. You know, and so it was a great accomplishment, but the law was rather gingerly applied for a number of years because people were afraid that there might be a legal challenge and no one quite knew what would happen. And finally, when Grand Central was threatened, the Landmarks Commission really drew a line in the sand and said, you know, if this law can't save Grand Central, I mean, we're willing to risk the law to save Grand Central. And indeed, it was litigated, went all the way to Supreme Court, and the Landmarks Law was upheld.
Really?
And so, in a sense, Grand Central has played a key role in the evolution of the Landmarks Law. So that really removed any doubts about the constitutionality of the law. That decision came down in 1978.
As the decision moved its way, wended its way up to the Supreme Court, were there moments when people held their breath?
Oh, all along the way. I mean, as you know, with these legal challenges, there was a lower court decision in New York that went the wrong way. And there was some question as to whether the city of New York would actually appeal it or whether they would kind of, you know, just live with this bad decision. And they were afraid that they were going to end up owing the Penn Central Company, which owned Grand Central, you know, a ton of money. But fortunately, the city was strongly encouraged by many civic advocates and did the right thing, appealed it, all the way went up through the courts. But until the decision came, you know, you never know how the Supreme – back then you never knew, and today even more so. You don't know what's going to come from the Supreme Court. And Jackie Onassis went to Washington. The Municipal Arts Society organized a train called the Landmark Express, and she went down to Washington, and a trainload of New Yorkers went down because the whole notion was to let the Supreme – I mean, things like that don't decide Supreme Court decisions, nor should they, but it does help the court understand – a lot of people are looking, and it's a very important issue.
So give us a little tour through the preservation groups, because there are several of them. I'd love to know a little about who they are so we can have our own play-by-play.
Sure, sure. And one of the great things over the last 50 years as the Landmarks Law came into being and has been used is kind of a growing robustness, if you will, within kind of the nonprofit preservation community.
So, this state legislature or the Congress?
No. This is now we're talking kind of nonprofit groups.
Okay.
So we're talking civic advocacy groups.
Yes, but when you say the law.
Law. So the Landmarks Law, right, was a New York state law. Well, here's just a little background. So as most people probably know, in order for a city in New York State to pass certain types of law, it needs state enabling legislation. And actually, this is also another big anniversary. This is the 60th anniversary of something called the Bard Act, which was passed in 1956, which was the state enabling legislation, which gave cities around the state, if they wanted, the ability to have a landmarks law. So that was 56. And in 65, New York City took advantage of that and passed its landmarks law. So that was kind of how that law came into place. And so this robust group of civic groups, this kind of community of civic groups, you know, when the Landmarks Law was passed, one of the advocates said, the price of preservation is constant vigilance. And so a law is really only as good as people make it. And one of the great things about the Landmarks Law is it was the people's law. This wasn't, you know, a dictum coming down from a bunch of politicians who said, oh, I think New York should have a landmarks law. This is a result of decades of civic advocacy and painful losses to the city of New York of key buildings. So it's been the people's law, and the people have to be involved to keep it working the right way. So the groups that are out there, probably the mother of all preservation groups in New York City is the Municipal Arts Society, you know, created back during the inspired by the Chicago World's Fair. 1893 came into being. These New Yorkers came back to New York having seen this incredibly, what a city could look like, you know, in Chicago, and said, we want a beautiful city in New York. So the Municipal Arts Society was created back then around city beautiful issues, which today mean planning and preservation, things of that type. So the Municipal Arts Society was kind of the lead organization in New York around these issues and helped drive the call for the landmarks law. They were joined by other groups, Society of Architectural Historians, AIA, but they were kind of the flying the preservation flag. So out of the Municipal Arts Society, over time, have grown other groups. So there's a group that grew out of the Municipal Arts Society called the Historic Districts Council, a citywide group. And that basically is an umbrella group for all the historic neighborhoods in the city that are historic districts and want to become districts.
Well, who isn't a historic district? I grew up on the West Side. It's a district. Greenwich Village is a district, right?
Greenwich Village is a district. Well, there's a very, you know, specific legal process that one goes through in order to have a neighborhood become a historic district. They all certainly don't qualify.
You know, doesn't qualify?
Who doesn't? Oh, well, I'll tell you, a friend of mine runs the Historic Districts Council, and he's got a list of like 45 neighborhoods that desperately want to become historic districts, you know, and a lot of them in the outer boroughs, which haven't received the same attention as, you know, as we know how those things go. But so the process, you know, the Landmarks Commission, which is a city agency, has a research staff. They do lots of research. They figure out what the boundaries should be. They look at the history. They hold public hearings. They hear objections. They hear people pros and cons. And ultimately, they make the decision. But it's a political decision. I mean, they make it, hopefully on the merits, sometimes one wonders. But and then it goes through, and the city council has to log in. And ultimately, you know, the mayor has the final say in terms of his ability. If the city council rejects something, he can then veto. It's one of those, the usual kind of process. So there's a whole process to create these districts. So the Historic Districts Council is the nonprofit group that kind of pulls them all together as a voice for those neighborhoods and helps the neighborhoods that want to be districts with helping them understand how the system works, how to do the advocacy, how to promote it. So the Historic Districts Council, very robust, grassroots, citywide, which grew out of the Municipal Arts Society, started life as a little committee at the Municipal Arts Society. Then there's a group called the New York Landmarks Conservancy, which also kind of grew out of the Landmarks, grew out of the Municipal Arts Society, helped launch it back in, I think, 1971. And it was created because at that time, I mean, one of the things, one of the reasons the Landmarks Law has been upheld in the courts, it doesn't lock things in. Some people think if you're landmark, that's the end of it. Mm. Not the case. There's a fairness dimension to it. There's a hardship provision. If an owner can provide a hardship as defined by the law, then a landmark can be demolished.
What's an example of a hardship?
It's a legally described financial hardship. It deals with kind of return. For for-profits, it's kind of it's around return on investment for the property. For nonprofits, it deals more with the impact of the designation on the use of the building is the terms. So when the law was passed, there was a realization, because there was this hardship provision, that there were going to be buildings that needed help. And if they didn't get help, then we'd lose them because, in a sense, there was this fail-safe dimension to the law. So the Landmarks Conservancy was created partially to be a group with the hands-on technical skills, kind of have architects on staff, have revolving loan funds, so they could actually help owners of buildings to make them work, to make them ultimately not suffer from a hardship. And so the Landmarks Conservancy has grown over the years, has some grant programs, has also you know, logs in on advocacy issues. And they're citywide. They have one statewide program, which is a wonderful grant program for sacred sites, basically religiously owned buildings around the state, which has been around now for probably celebrated an anniversary. I'm embarrassed to say I can't remember how many, but it's actually the Kaplan Fund, where I worked many years ago, helped launch that financially. And that's helped churches and houses of worship all over New York State. Really wonderful accomplishment. So those three are kind of the citywide groups, MAS, the Historic Districts Council, Landmarks Conservancy, are kind of the three that have been there for a number of years.
Citywide. They get along?
Oh, now you know the nonprofit world better than that. Let's put it this way. They often have different opinions, and sometimes they don't work in harmony as much as one would like. But, you know, it's like anything else in life. When there's a significant enough threat, everybody figures out common ground and comes together and you know, works in defense of preservation. So they all have their different kind of piece of turf. Now, that's just the city, though. We haven't mentioned another group, which is really, I think, would be a particular interest to a lot of viewers around the state, and that's the Preservation League of New York State. And that's our statewide preservation group. And most states in the country now have a statewide group. Ours is particularly robust. And really, you know, their fingerprints, you can find all every corner of the state. They have great technical assistance. So when there's a city that's looking for help, perhaps on doing a landmarks law, or a landmark owner has some technical problems and needs help, or a group of citizens are trying to figure out, how do we save our old downtown movie theater, or we've got this, you know, abandoned church building that's so important to the fabric of our city. So the Preservation League, whose offices are just a few blocks from where we're sitting here, you have been around and provide that service. So they're the statewide piece of, if you will, the architecture of kind of preservation.
Of course, there are things upstate that are worth preserving,
too.
Oh, my
God. New York State, I have to tell you, many years ago, when I worked at the Kaplan Fund with Joan Davidson, the fund decided it was going to do more funding around the state. They'd been limited primarily to New York City. And I got the wonderful assignment of kind of taking their programs across the state. And I remember Joan Davidson, who I think has been a lead voice in helping New York City people understand the richness of the rest of the state. She was an early voice for that. She said, oh, Tony, you just wait and see. You know, you're going to love the Southern Tier. You're going to love this. And I kind of rolled my eyes at, like, you know, this, what she's saying. And I got to tell you, getting around the state, you know, getting to fly out near Chautauqua, you know, driving through those communities, I would usually fly in somewhere and then kind of do a circle of visiting projects, organizations, the Adirondacks, Tug Hill. I mean, God, this state, I've often said, if you were limited to live your entire life in the boundary of one state, you'd pick New York State. The greatest beaches, the high peaks of the Adirondacks. You look at the midriff of the state, the great ag land. I mean, this state has it all. And it's been, over the years, just a privilege. And what's great about the league is the league recognizes that and is here to help the entire state.
So I wanted to ask you something. We are talking to Anthony Wood, a preservationist. I wanted to ask you something, Anthony, and that is, what happens in order to, I don't know how to put this well, but it seems to me that quite often we lump together people who want to put in land preservation, building preservation. We say, these are rich people. You have this sort of interest. How do we get everybody involved?
Well, that's just not the case anymore. Maybe back in the day, but I even question that. One of the great things I've seen over the years I've been doing preservation, particularly in New York City, is the changing attitudes in the other boroughs, if you will, and neighborhoods out there, working class neighborhoods, neighborhoods with great diversity, new immigrants, old immigrants, are now coming to, have come to realize that where they live has one, you know, there's a wonderful environment there, and they want that protected. They don't think this should just be something that benefits people living on the Upper East Side. In a sense, they're saying we deserve equal attention because our neighborhoods have architecture that's as interesting, as distinguished, as compelling. We have a history, we have a culture, we have a narrative here that's worthy of preservation. So seeing those changes over the years has been great.
Are you winning or losing? My father, I'm old now, but my father used to take us down to the Lower East Side and Orchard Street. We do all our buying down there.
Yeah,
you would haggle with people and the rest of it. It's all gone.
Well, the Tenement Museum is doing some stuff. There's some
yes,
groups
indeed.
Pushing to get more things protected down there. Well, you've got to look at this in a historical perspective. So in one sense, you got to say the glass is half full. I mean, it's kind of a miracle in one sense that New York, a city with the power of real estate, the impetus for constant change, the fact that we've actually saved 138 or whatever neighborhoods. There's something like 34,000 buildings that are protected by the landmarks law. Now, that's less than 3.5% of the city. So there's a lot more worthy of protection, but it's kind of an urban miracle that's been able to be protected. On the other hand, I mean, the pressures against saving neighborhoods in New York just get ratcheted up every year.
Sure.
And that's why the citizen advocacy piece is so important, because we're up against, in many cases, the real estate industry of New York. We know that's just an engine that's fueled and driven by all sorts of forces. And I mean,
but we know how much money they've recently been accused of giving to politicians.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's not my area of expertise, but I will say that, you know, eyebrows have been raised over the years about how certain things have happened, and now maybe we're figuring out a little more why.
Well, being that you're in the hot seat, I would ask you this. When you discover, for example, that Governor Cuomo, for example, has taken immense amounts of money from the real estate industry, isn't there always, even if it's not provable, a quid pro quo?
I have to tell you, personally, it's hard to imagine. There's certainly, at the minimum, they get access. And access is really important. If you don't have access...
Access is power.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're, as they say, I guess it's a Washington saying, you know, if you're not at the table, you're probably on the menu. And preservationists have been trying to get at the table for a long time because... when you look at the political dynamic, sometimes we are on the menu. And I think that's part of the challenge we face in New York City today is, you know, the mayor has a set of priorities. You know, preservation, landmarks, history just are not among them. And, you know...
But when we see, Anthony Wood, when we see a mayor taking immense amounts of money from one or two people in a campaign,
yeah.
And then when caught doing it, has to return the money... it's almost an admission that he shouldn't have been taking it in the first place.
Look, I have to tell you, campaign reform, if that could be accomplished, it would be transformative, not just for preservation and land use, but so many of the things citizens care about. So I wish I knew the answer to that, but it is, you're right, it is so essential. And until that gets solved, it will be a continual uphill battle. Doesn't mean it's a battle you can't win at times. But frankly, you know, the victories when you're up against those forces are less than the losses we experience.
Now, Anthony Wood, there is a sense that I have that there's always a way around preservation. You identified some of that earlier in terms of some of the qualifications that got put into the law. But one of them that I think you probably ought to address for a minute is the concept of air rights.
Oh, boy, there's an interesting one, and we're seeing some of the results of that today on 57th Street, New York, as these super tall buildings come up. So, I mean, air rights are basically, you know, that unused development potential that sits above a building, sometimes a landmark, sometimes a non-landmark. And the smart developers figure out how you pile all up in one place, and technology has now allowed that pile to be taller than ever before. And I think we're seeing a change in New York that is fundamental in terms of the impact on the city. The skyline of New York will never be the same. When they're done building the row of buildings on 57th Street, there will be a wall that cuts the city across then. One of the areas that I'm hoping someday we'll make progress on, and hopefully there'll be something left, is the ability to protect some of the skyline of New York as actually a treasured value of the city. And it's certainly under attack. The landmarks law doesn't call that out as an easy thing to preserve. There might be something else that's needed. And that's one of the things I think as we look at this 50th anniversary of what the law has done, a couple of things. First, the history of the law is inspiring because it took years to accomplish it. And this Bard Act I mentioned, it took Albert Bard over 40 years to see his idea that cities ought to have the right to regulate on aesthetics become law, right? It takes that long for a transformative idea. Today, we need to be launching similar ideas. So we need to be figuring out how can we save historic viewsheds? How can we save the skyline? We also need to be looking at some new tools to really help advance preservation. I think there should be a land transfer tax in New York City so that any transfer of a certain level, pick your number of millions, that, you know, 0.00001% of that should go into a pot of money, and that money could be used to help restore landmarks that are owned by nonprofits, some of the churches, some of the sites that are owned by nonprofits that genuinely could benefit from that help. Now, there are some counties in New York State that have that already, where a land transfer tax can be used to save open space, historic resources, and the like. But we need some new ideas on the table to really help advance something. One of the wonderful things about this, we've had a 2-year celebration of this 50th anniversary of the Landmarks Law. And one of the wonderful things has been seeing the continuing outpouring of interest in the law, support for the law, and a love of landmarks. And the groups that have been lined up, I mean, I went through the major groups. This is like, I think over 180 groups have come together, whether it's like the Scottish Society. There's lots of group, cultural groups, art groups, neighborhood groups have all seen this as a wonderful opportunity to lift up what they care about. So the good news is that the people of New York, who, as I said, were responsible for the law, still are hugely supportive of the law, want it used more aggressively, want it used, I think, at a higher level of implementation than it has been. But we're up against, you know, politics. We're up against real estate. And as you look at those buildings on 57th Street, I mean, those are vertical safety boxes. money from across the world that needs a safe home to be tucked away when the owners need it because something happens in the country they're in.
In Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, you pick a country, you know, Russia, China. Yeah. I mean, that's where that money's going. And it's not only destroying the sense of what New York is like, but it's also going to have, it just has a huge impact. I have to say, I have not seen as many, I'm going to say, civilian New Yorkers, people who aren't advocates by nature, who just, you know, walk the streets of New York, in conversations I've had with them, be so unhappy.
Absolutely.
About this transformation of the skyline. This building, 432 Park Avenue, is like, there's nowhere you can't see it. I was out on a boat in the harbor, you see it. I was hiking in the Palisades under the George Washington Bridge, you can see it. And it's not going to be alone. So there is a conversation going on in terms of what should the future of New York look like.
Well, Anthony Wood, somebody will argue with you, and so therefore I think it falls to me whether I like it or not, to say, well, at one point the Empire State Building got put up, and people got ticked off about that and said, you're blocking my view or my sunlight or whatever else. How do the new ones differ from that one?
Well, I think one of the differences is, as a city, we've matured now. So in a sense, we have the opportunity to make some choices about what we want to save and what we don't want to save, what's worthy of preserving and bringing into the future and what isn't. So in a sense, the Landmarks Law wasn't passed to make sure every important building would be preserved, but it was passed to create a process so that at least we'd have an opportunity. And that's kind of the Penn Station lesson, was that there was no process by which New Yorkers could come forward and try and make a case or present an alternative in a meaningful way to save Penn Station. And so the Landmarks Law was created to create that opportunity. So I think that the difference is, the other thought is, look, as I said, there's like less than 3.5% of the city that's in any way regulated by the Landmarks Commission, right? And say I'm a radical and you want to double that, right? You know, still that leaves a huge amount of New York open for wonderful new buildings, dramatic architecture, but it doesn't have to be an either-or proposition. In a sense, they're great spots in the city. The problem is that, you know, people want to transform initially a midtown to look like Shanghai. And well, there's some people that feel that's the right vision. I'm not one of them.
Well, I have to tell you, Anthony Wood, a friend recently took me up to a 15th floor roof garden in a house on 89th Street, I guess it is, and said, look out there. And there were your 57th Street building coming up. And said, they've ruined our view.
Yeah.
So the common guy, the middle-class person or woman, are offended by it.
Yeah. Well, also, I mean, it's not just about somebody's personal view or, you know, being lost. No, I mean, that may motivate some folks. But I think it's also a sense of the city and how you experience the city and what it looks like. I mean, the historic skyline of New York actually is something of value, and that goes beyond, you know, whether it ruins my view or doesn't ruin my view. I mean, there's a value to that. It's kind of an iconic dimension.
Well, let me stop you. Take the World Trade Center.
Yeah.
It gets knocked down. It gets blown up. Terrible, terrible, terrible tragedy for New York. How has that affected, that change in the skyline, New York?
I got to tell you, I'm a big fan of some old TV series, and one of them is Murder, She Wrote, right? You know,
right, sure.
There was a whole number of years that episodes were in New York. Almost every one of those episodes at some point has a shot of the World Trade Center, right?
I mean,
sure. So in a sense, it became part of the shorthand iconography of New York. You saw that, you knew where you were, right? And so there are other views of New York, other glimpses that you know it's New York, you know it's not Shanghai, right? What to me is going to be tragic is when the Chrysler Building and the Empire State Building become invisible because they've been surrounded. And there's this building that's under construction near Grand Central. I think it's called One Vanderbilt Avenue, that is going to tower over the Chrysler Building. And so soon the Chrysler Building potentially is going to be surrounded by a wall of buildings. That will be a tragic loss for a sense of what the city is about. And this goes beyond, you know, kind of a narrow preservation thing, but just urbanistically. You also have to look at kind of quality of life issues. When this building by Grand Central is built, on one hand, people say it's great. It's near a transportation hub. Well, it's near a transportation hub that's basically saturated. You know, walk through that part of Midtown today, and you almost you know, need a cattle prod to get through the streets. Imagine that building is going to bring thousands and thousands of more people. So there's kind of an urban functionality. There's a livability. There's a quality of life that, in a sense, if a place becomes too unpleasant to live, people can make choices, and the choices won't be great for New York. What's been great for New York is people want to be here, and they don't want to be here because it looks like Shanghai. They want to be here because of what New York is.
Well, I don't know why, Anthony, would they want to be here. I know so many people want to be here that the price of New York real estate, I know a guy who bought an apartment for $400,000 10 years ago that's worth $1 million or close to $1 million now. He very much, and she, his wife, appreciate the fact that this piece of property in a co-op is so much more expensive now and that they can realize a profit on their investment. They also, I think there are those people who think that you and your friends who are doing this, what I consider to be magnificent work, are sort of pulling up the gangplank and saying, we're here, we don't want you.
Oh, you know, that probably isn't is the right criticism. There's certainly some appropriate questions to raise about kind of the potential impacts of some of this. But the neighborhoods now, I mean, that are trying to get protected are not, you know, the enclaves of the rich and famous. I mean, they're places where basically normal New Yorkers, black, white, you name it, live and value that place. So I think the charge that's been issued against preservation, I think unfairly, is this question of, well, you know, if you preserve these buildings, then you can't tear them down and build these skyscrapers, right? So in a sense, you're denying, you know, other people the ability because you're keeping these areas low. There's a study that just came out that the Furman Center did that's just shown that the kind of the density in these areas in historic neighborhoods are denser than some other parts of the city and are certainly as dense because it's people aren't building a skyscraper and having three apartments, you know, three floors for their triplex because they're a Russian oligarch. People have confused high rises with density. And so preservation, in my mind, has been this great ability to preserve neighborhoods, stabilize neighborhoods, make them desirable. And it hasn't, when you look at the totality of New York, as I say, there's so much of New York not in any way influenced by preservation that, you know, to suggest preservation in some way is limiting what happens in New York kind of ignores the 94% of the city that's unencumbered.
Okay, I want to ask you a series of questions here, starting with, all right, Mayor de Blasio. He says, okay, you can build, but you have to have a certain amount of affordable apartments within the buildings that you're building. Doesn't that offer a sort of justification for allowing more construction?
Oh, well, yeah, no, de Blasio is, you know, basically said in a way that if Bloomberg had ever said it, I think he would have been crucified. I mean, de Blasio has almost said, you know, build whatever you want, just throw me some affordable housing, right?
Right.
And in a sense, so the city is basically using zoning. I mean, there are other ways to address that. And I think there's some real questions when you look at the people who are affordable housing experts who are kind of questioning this approach. You know, how much of a dent is it really going to make? And at what ultimate cost is it happening? Mm. So the other way, you know, instead of adding height, you could also say, look, you can't build to the existing height unless you put in some affordable housing. Uh-huh. But if you look at it, I don't see a lot of affordable housing coming as a result of those buildings on 57th Street. You know,
Well, yeah.
I don't see it.
Okay. So we have, you know, this phenomena of people with a lot of money building. You have the cooperative movement in New York. If people are listening to this, they may not exactly know what a cooperative apartment is and that boards of co-ops have ways of looking at encroaching buildings and others that are coming near them that they don't like, that their line of sight is stopped. So there's this whole bunch of good motives and maybe not so good motives that help the preservationists.
Well, I've always said you got to tease out motives from merit, right?
I mean, I like that. Tease out motives from merit.
Right. I mean, you know, there's some really meritorious arguments that can be brought forward by people whose, you know, motivation is the wrong motivation. Somebody may be saying, you know, I want to save a building because it's their view. Well, if it's an important historic building with great culture and history, their motive isn't.
You don't care.
You know, in a sense, the Landmarks Law isn't about motive. It's about, you know, is this building that or neighborhood, does it meet the standards of the law? history, culture, architectural quality. And so, I mean, God, in New York, trying to tease out everybody's motives could keep you busy for a very, very long time.
Sure.
It's, you know, back to the super tall buildings, as they're being called. You know, when you also scratch the surface about the subsidies involved, et cetera, I mean, it's interesting, you know, people benefiting from subsidies who are kind of the last people on earth who need to benefit from subsidies because sure. The way the rules have been manipulated. And actually, I enjoyed the conversation you had at the end of last year with Roberta Gratz, who I thought was, you know, particularly kind of eloquent on that point. But again, you know, what's great about this 50th anniversary and having focused on the law is it's given us a chance to kind of reflect on what has been accomplished in 50 years and to kind of take stock of that. This Furman report I mentioned, which people can get online, has kind of done that looking through one lens. Landmarks Conservancy has a report that's coming out, I think, shortly on kind of the economic benefits of that we've seen.
I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah.
You build a big building.
Yeah.
You got a subway, which can hardly hold the people.
Yeah.
And it, you know, I mean, you get on the number two train, number one train on the west side on the IRT, what we used to call the IRT. God knows what they call it now.
Right.
And, you know, it's already packed like sardines. You build a bigger building, you have to change the infrastructure.
Well, I think that's part of, when I say this is larger than historic preservation, I mean, when you look at some of these trade-offs, so this building I mentioned that's going on Vanderbilt Avenue, right?
Sure.
They were allowed to go very high, and they made a contribution to help with transportation. I think it was like $240 million. $240 million hardly buys you two, you know, penthouse apartments on 57th Street anymore. So, I mean, to me, that was kind of a ridiculous to justify it. But you're absolutely right. The structure of New York City, the infrastructure, isn't sufficient to hold the development that's being proposed and that's in the works. And the infrastructure that exists needs to be reinvested in anyway.
I mean, do the preservationists make that argument when they're arguing against allowing a building to be put up?
Well, you know, again, we're kind of convoluting kind of the preservation piece of the land use conversation and the broader piece. So there are people who are like, I'm a preservationist, but I also have other urban issues that
Where do you live?
I live on the Upper East Side, 94th Street, Park Avenue. Sadly, in a building that it lacked so much architectural merit that it seems to, every time they expand the Carnegie Hill Historic District, they manage to make sure my building isn't in it. But I do look
when
at
When was
Landmark.
It built?
Oh, like 1960s, you know.
So it's post-war.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's not, you know, it's nothing.
Are you better off living in a pre-war building in terms of hoping that your preservation rights are more accredited?
You know, there's been one of the things that has evolved is there's a great greater appreciation you now for modern buildings. Yeah, that's been one of the kind of generational shifts in the preservation movement. It's actually kind of ironic in an interesting way because some of the people who advocated for the landmarks law back when it was, you know, an idea and before it was passed were horrified by some buildings being built at that time that since then have been designated landmarks because we have come to appreciate, you know, styles change. And one of the brilliant things about the landmarks law, when it was written, they could have decided, we're just going to call out specifically what we care about, right? We're going to care about Beaux-Arts buildings, or we're going to care about, you know. And instead, they didn't define styles, which was so smart because it allows us to be a living law, recognizing that what we felt, what people valued, what people think is important is going to change over time. I remember years ago, we were trying to designate a Victorian building, right? And one of the landmarks commissioners at the time said, I grew up in an old mill town with that oppressive architecture. I can't see any value in preserving. Well, today, that building would be, you know, almost a slam dunk because tastes have evolved and changed. So modern buildings now, you know, Lever House and all, sure. And their organization specifically focused on trying to get those buildings protected. Docomomo.
So when I grew up on the west side, a couple of things. Number one, I grew up on 96th Street between Central Park and Columbus. Everything between 96th Street and 86th Street was literally considered slum. Now every one of those buildings are millions and millions and millions of dollars. That wealth has to, because wealthy people are powerful people, has to help you.
I have to tell you, I mean, that's one of the reasons why when you look at a neighborhood like that, so the conventional planning wisdom back then would have been tear it all down, right?
Absolutely.
And city after city, neighborhood after neighborhood had that fate. And instead, because of another way of looking at urbanism, not the Robert Moses way, but more the Jane Jacobs way, I mean, people have realized those neighborhoods can indeed are worth reinvestment and are wonderful places to live. And so the people who live in those neighborhoods appreciate them and value them. And I have to say, you know, I know I wouldn't be able to afford to live in that neighborhood today, but boy, I can walk through that neighborhood for free and enjoy an architecture. I jokingly say I live on the East Side. I say when I go to the West Side, it's like going to Paris, but I don't have to buy an airline ticket, right? I mean, it's kind of a distinctly different type of neighborhood and feel. We all get to enjoy that. It's one of the magnets for tourism in the city. So the wisdom of those people who fought decades and decades ago to make sure we could protect neighborhoods like that, we are benefiting from today. The city is benefiting from today.
Yeah. So Manhattan is one thing. The outer boroughs, as we call them, my friends used to say, I'm going to the city to visit Shartok if they lived in Queens.
Yeah.
The outer boroughs are now the hotbed.
You know, one of the most remarkable things was if you would have told me 25 years ago that people would, young people coming to New York, living in New York, would consciously choose to live in Brooklyn.
Well, they had to consciously because there was nothing they could afford in Manhattan. Now Brooklyn is as expensive as Manhattan.
No, absolutely. But I mean, that Brooklyn is now the first choice. It's not plan B. In fact, I met a young lady at a reception not long ago who proudly announced, she said, oh, I'm so lucky. I'm tired of this crazy life in Brooklyn. I found a nice, cheaper, quieter apartment. I'm moving to Yorkville on the Upper East Side.
That's funny.
Yeah. And so, but what's great about that urbanistically is if Brooklyn can become that hot, think of Queens.
No.
I mean, think of the Bronx. I mean,
I know I have a lot of friends who live in Astoria.
Oh,
young
yeah.
people live in Astoria.
Yeah.
Astoria's become the place.
Yeah. Well, and those neighborhoods are now very worried about the type of, I mean,
sure.
there's just this big battle that just happened in the city about zoning changes. And that's not my area of expertise, but a lot of the neighborhoods who banded together against that, and a huge opposition across the city at the neighborhood level, are afraid that their neighborhoods are going to experience a type of new development. It's not going to be the super talls from 57th, but it's going to be, in their mind, as disruptive to their neighborhood and threaten the quality of life, the existing housing stock, affordable housing. So, I mean, boy, when you go to Brooklyn, the number of cranes you see, the number of buildings popping up, you know, the huge economic activity all over the city.
Tony, what would Karl Marx have said about all this?
It's always a mistake to play that game. But you're taking us to this issue that's being discussed more and more, which is income inequality. And I think that's, when you think about it, we're in a capitalistic system. And you know, things of value get bid up by those who can bid them up. And that's part of the game. It's a real issue, and it's fascinating, the conversation that's finally happening around it, which is long overdue.
How much work do you and your colleagues have to do to convince more than the handful of people who are interested, really interested in preservation? What do you have to do? Do you have to hire public relations people? Do you have to have a cause célèbre at some point? What do you do?
Well, it's interesting. Probably one of the greatest dangers to preservation at the moment is people just taking it for granted, just kind of assuming that the wonderful buildings and neighborhoods we like are just always going to be there. Somebody else is taking care of it. You know, we don't have to worry about it. And so part of it is always trying to remind, and that's one reason why this 50th anniversary is so important, why this group I started called the New York Preservation Archive Project is so important. We're telling the story, the history of preservation efforts in New York, to remind people that these places that have survived have not survived by accident. They've survived because people fought to keep them.
So let's follow up on the Archive Project.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell us more about that.
Oh, well, the Archive Project is a lot of fun. When I came to New York back in 1978, wanting to get involved with historic preservation, and my background was a historian, I said, I'm going to read the book on the history of the preservation movement. Right? I want to know what I'm getting involved with, who the people are. There was no book. There was no article. There was nothing. And preservation had no sense of its own history. Now, that's ironic, obviously, because these are people running around saving buildings that really call out the history of so many other sections of New York life. But it also made perfect sense because they were like Dalmatians, right? I mean, the ultimate deadline is demolition, right? So you're madly running around saving buildings. You're not thinking about how you've done it, the history of it, who was involved, what did we learn from that? And so that was kind of the motivation ultimately for me to start this organization, was to try and let preservationists know that they had a history, a long tradition, lots could be learned from it. The other reason was there are some New York historians, well known, who make the case or try to make the case that New York is all about change. That's a fundamental characteristic of New York. And anything that doesn't, that gets in the way of change is then fundamentally non-New York. And that something like preservation is like the new guy on the block. You know, Penn Station, demolished in 63. That's like a new chapter in New York's history. What we've done is kind of unveil that there was, you know, a 50, 100 years, decades of preservation history well before the Penn Station incident. And so, in a sense, New Yorkers have been trying to manage change, which is partially what preservation
does. Give us one example of a historical antecedent to the law.
Oh, well, there were huge battles in the 40s to save Castle Clinton in Lower Manhattan. From a misguided Robert Moses affair, a decade-long battle to save that building. There were efforts in the 40s, even in the 40s, the people of Greenwich Village were writing the Vieux Carré in New Orleans saying, how do you guys do this? How did you get your law? How did you protect it? You know, I think in 1951 was when the head of the Municipal Arts Society first said there ought to be a landmarks law. They started looking at what should be saved. You know, before you can have a movement or to pass a law or anything, you have to go through certain steps. People have to say, well, what are you talking about? I mean, what are the things you care about? So you had to begin to identify them. So just before World War I, the Municipal Arts Society began to develop a list of important buildings. Then World War II came, you know, kind of threw everything out of kilter. And then post-war development heated things up, and buildings started to come down that people were totally shocked were coming down. So in the early 50s, the Municipal Arts Society kind of revisited this list, put it together, refined it, worked with the Society of Architectural Historians. So you now had, this is what's at stake. This is what we care about. And then it was, how do you build a constituency to care about it? And so there were walking tours. I mean, believe it or not, walking tours were once a new thing. I mean, if you think the New York's sidewalks are crowded, some of it's walking tours, which is great. But so they did walking tours, they did exhibits. In a sense, they began to build a constituency.
So how does one access the archives?
Oh, we have a wonderful new website that I, fingers crossed, will be up in about probably 3 or 4 weeks. We've got a present website, but the new one's going to be so much better, where you can come in and you can ask a question. In a sense, we have a database that kind of talks about historic preservation issues, battles, figures. We're interesting. We're not a collecting organization because that would take a lot more money than I can ever raise. But what we do is a lot of preservationists are neighborhood advocates, right? I mean, if you're a lawyer, your papers might go to your alma mater. You know, if you're an architect, your papers might go to Avery Library. But if you're Ruth Wittenberg, one of the great fighters in the village, or any of those great civic leaders who were basically, many of them housewives, their papers were ending up in dumpsters. And so what we do now is we reach out to those people and find a home for their papers to make sure the story of saving a neighborhood, saving a building is saved. So we connect people who have great historic resources with collecting institutions. We do oral histories. We just finished a series of oral histories with all the past chairs of the Landmarks Commission so that we kind of have a narrative over time of what they thought they were doing, the accomplishments. We're now doing a series of oral histories capturing the story of preservation in pretty much the outer boroughs. They're kind of stories that haven't emerged. And so we're building a collection of oral histories to preserve that narrative. And then we also we celebrate the history of preservation. So we've been very involved working with the Landmarks 50 Alliance, which is the umbrella group that's been doing this two-year celebration of the Landmarks Law. Wonderful effort put together by Barbara Lee Diamondstein, which has really just galvanated so much in the city. So we've been working heavily on that. But we also have fun things. We call it Preservation She Wrote. So we've taken an old episode of Murder, She Wrote that has a preservation theme. You know, Jessica Fletcher is trying to get involved in saving a bar on the Upper East Side. And this really appeals to the younger preservationists. So you come in and you see, how is preservation portrayed back in the 70s when that episode was put on? And how has preservation changed? How has the public perception of preservation changed? So we try and get people to think about context, because context really helps you understand what we've been through, and it also informs some of the challenges ahead and gives us some real good tools.
We're talking with Anthony Wood, a grants maker, philanthropic advisor, preservation activist, writer, teacher, and historian. Okay, you said in the beginning that it was tough to figure out why people were doing this. In other words, what you're interested in is the fact that it's happening. I have a now past cousin who I adored who came out in Brooklyn Foursquare against the new bicycle paths that were around.
Yeah.
Now, she wasn't fooling me. She didn't want this bicycle path in front of her really beautiful home during that time. I think you may have a problem in that while you think it doesn't matter, it does matter to a lot of people why people are doing things.
Oh, yeah. No, it does. And if you understand the motivation, you can also then educate people. You know, it's the same with the wonderful, you know, Rails to Trails movement around the state, you know, and a lot of people worried about, you're going to have these people walking on these trails, these old rail lines, you know, going through private property, et cetera. And people are scared of sure. different things. And, you know, you can help educate them. So I think people sometimes, you know, like your cousin and the, I mean, I think people now understand how these things work differently. And there is a larger public good. And I mean, often, and in my mind, preservation is often that larger public good. And sometimes people need to understand why it's a value. And the fact we have a law shows that the decision makers agree and the courts agree it's a public good.
Anthony, you have a tremendous background in philanthropy. You gave out money, you got money. Who do you go to for money for something like this?
Well, preservation is like raising money for any other good cause. You have to kind of figure out who cares and help them understand why the work is important.
Well, who does
and educate.
Care?
Well, when it comes to preservation, I mean, it's funny. There are not as many funding sources as there were maybe 20 years ago. Some of the foundations have moved on or closed down. A lot of individuals, a lot of private citizens care. I mean, some preservation efforts are now getting funded through Kickstarter and kind of that kind of democratizing of philanthropy, which is really so exciting, that change in philanthropy.
Is this an old person's thing or a young person's thing? I mean, you know, you mentioned that you worked for the Idelson Foundation.
Right.
Old man Idelson made a lot of money and put money into his foundation. The question I've always had about philanthropy is, are the children of the major philanthropists as interested? Because after all, they didn't grow up with those buildings. And why are their concerns as great?
That's just a larger question. And philanthropy is kind of the, you know, donor intent, you know, donor intent. And then what happens when the donor passes on, goes to their reward? And what do the subsequent generations do with the money in philanthropy? And some of that depends on the type of philanthropy. So I've worked primarily for family foundations. So the Idelson Foundation, which is absolutely wonderful foundation, we fund in three areas. We fund mental health, AIDS, and the environment. And mental health was the original focus of that foundation, you know, three generations ago. And they still honor that tradition and are still excited about funding that. But they then added over time areas that reflected current members of the family's interest. And so there you kind of see a natural evolution over time. But there's great debates, you know. People say, like, the Ford Foundation, you know, oh, my God, you know, what would he think today about what the foundation
Indeed.
Is doing? Yeah. And it's, you know, there's a lot of interesting conversations that go on.
Well, the old man
that.
Was a scurrilous anti-Semite. We know that. But the kids have created, probably, and their kids, one of the most liberal institutions in the world.
Oh, yeah. And Darren Walker, who's a relatively new president of Ford Foundation, wonderful, wonderful guy. I mean, focusing it on very important issues. And he's a great story. Darren kind of is the philanthropic equivalent of, you know, somebody who kind of started in the mailroom and worked up. I mean, he worked for nonprofits. He then worked for foundations. He was at Ford. And it was brilliant of them to hire him. One of the mistakes, I think, that some of the new philanthropists, the new money, the venture capital guys, the hedge fund guys, is that they basically say, well, you know, philanthropy's never been done right before. I'm going to do it right. And then they bring in somebody who knows nothing about philanthropy, and it doesn't go so well for a while. I mean, there is kind of a way to do – there's an approach to philanthropy, I think, that can be more successful than other approaches. So philanthropy is an interesting space. I mean, I was talking earlier, I mean, there's so much now with the new technology and kind of the democratizing of philanthropy, very exciting work going on there. But there are also, I think, some kind of downsides. I mean, there are people who believe that they made a lot of money. So, hey, look, if I made a lot of money, I can tell you how to run the opera. And I think that's a danger that philanthropy always has to be really careful of.
And when you're asking for a grant, it's something that you say, okay, if I take this money, what goes with it?
Well, I think, you know, the good news is unlike our earlier conversation maybe about political contributions is, you know, I guess it depends on the funding source, but, you know, you come to a funding source, you know, you with an application, this is what you want to do. And, you know, that's what that group is funding. Now, the where you get into kind of a dangerous area, I think, is when I believe that the people who really know how to do the work are not the people at the philanthropy. It's the people they fund. I mean, and as a philanthropist, we're looking for great ideas with people who can, we believe, can make them happen. I think the danger is when the philanthropists decide they know the answers and start, as you're saying, potentially dictate what they feel should be done. And then I would tell an organization, don't take the money. You know, don't take the money unless it's what you want to do.
Easy
and
for you.
And the way you want to do it.
Easy for you to say.
Well, you know, I work in philanthropy, but I spend about half my time looking for money because both the foundation, the Edelson Foundation, we're a leverage funder, so we never fully fund one of our grantees, but we then help them try and find the other money. So in that role and then serving on all these nonprofit boards, so I spend a lot of time looking for money. And frankly, I think almost every philanthropist should also have to sit on the other side of the table because it really humanizes you when you understand the difficulty of running a nonprofit, the challenges of it, and I think it keeps you honest as a philanthropist.
Well, I've seen people who sit on not-for-profit boards who are there for, as my twin brother Lewis used to say a lot, are there for bloodlust. You know, they're just there to cause hell.
You know, those are not the people you want on your board.
No,
right?
Those are not the people you want on your board. It's tough to kick somebody like that off a board.
Well, hopefully you were smart enough not to put them on in the first place. But
no, it takes is one.
Well, it's challenging. I mean, the dynamics of corporations, dynamics of nonprofits, I mean, it's a very interesting space. And I've been privileged enough to kind of be involved and observe it for years. And I mean, I've seen nonprofits, I've been involved with nonprofits that had like, you know, no money, and those that have had like $33 million budgets. And the bigger isn't necessarily the better.
No.
You know, and it's just interesting. It's, you know, you're dealing with people.
Should board members of not-for-profits be expected to put something in the kettle?
I think yes, but here's my caveat. I look at a nonprofit board like Noah's Ark, right? You
right.
know, two by two by two. So you need some people on that board who really know the subject matter of what that group is doing.
Right.
Everyone should be passionate about it, but you need some people who really know it. You need some people who know HR. You need some people who are lawyers. You need some people who can write checks. And so you need a mix. I think everyone on a nonprofit board should give. Doesn't necessarily mean at the same level.
We've been talking with Anthony Wood, a grants maker, philanthropic advisor, preservation activist, writer, teacher, and historian. Anthony Wood, I'm so impressed with you and everything you're doing. I appreciate your spending all this time with us. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It was delightful, and look forward to coming back in another umpteen years, right?
We'll absolutely.
We'll do it.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, president and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.